This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to Fine Tuning with Drew Taylor, your one-stop shop when it comes to animation news and commentary. I'm Drew's co-host, entertainment writer Jim Hill, and he and I are recording the show on Sunday, July 2nd, 2023. The show will go live on Tuesday, July 4th, and you and Katie will be well outside of LA at that point, right?
Yeah, we'll be up at Santa Barbara, so if anybody's around, come say hi. Yeah, we watched Cutter's Way last night to get in the Santa Barbara mood. Have you ever seen that movie?
Is that the one with Jeff Bridges or?
Yeah, Jeff Bridges and John Hurt, and they're kind of bumbling into a murder investigation. It's really, really great.
That is so weird you bring that up. I was researching Indiana Jones last week for looking at Lucasfilm and came across the original casting director for Indy. Actually, it came down to two people. They saw everybody in LA. It was Jeff Bridges and Tom Selleck. And Jeff Bridges, because he was just coming off of Michael Cimino,
Heaven's Gate.
Heaven's Gate, yes. And it was one of these things where, I mean, and what's interesting is obviously now that we've all managed to see Michael Cimino's original cut of the film, as opposed to the studio butchered cut of the film, we understand, oh, okay, it had a lot of promise. It was a good movie. But at that time, because I want to say it cost $44 million to make and then only made like $3.5 at the box office, everybody associated with it, it was one of these things that all their reputations took a ding. And supposedly, Jeff Bridges was looking for something to commercial to appear in, to recover from this. And so the casting director of Indy supposedly went to George Lucas and Spielberg and said, look, we can get Jeff Bridges for a lot more than, or a lot less than his usual quote. So you get a movie star to open your movie. But I guess it was Marshall Lucas who saw Tom Selleck's audition. In fact, have you seen this where it's Tom Selleck doing the Marion in the bar scene with Sean Young?
Yes, I have seen that.
Yeah. And Marsha was one's like, no, I think you want to go with this guy instead. So in the end, he gets cast. Jeff Bridges, you know, he's looking for a commercial thing to appear in. He agrees to do Tron, but in the interim, while, you know, they're waiting for Tron to go in front of the camera, he does Cutter's Way for MGM UA.
Yeah, and supposedly MGM, because Heaven's Gate hadn't been out yet, but they had seen the dailies,
right,
that's why they wanted him in Cutter's Way.
Interesting.
Because it was a United Artists movie.
That's right.
I think it ended up being released by a United Artists shingle, mm-hmm, because it was so disastrous in its initial run. But it's a really wonderful little movie, and if you've never seen it, yeah.
You know, when you look at the length and breadth of Jeff Bridges' career, I mean, don't get me wrong. Yes, he's in, you know, the Dino De Laurentiis King Kong. You know, I mean, every so often it's like, okay, that was a good choice. But no, he's done some delightful stuff. In fact, folks, we will get to the animation news in a moment. But it kind of made me think, you know, we lost Alan Arkin late last week. And when you look at everything that he did from animation, I mean, he's the magician Schmendrake in The Last Unicorn, or when I was running a cinema back in late 70s, early 80s, we got Andrew Bergman's The In-Laws, which was only supposed to run for 2 weeks, but hung in there for like 3 months because everybody loved Peter Falk and Alan Arkin together. I mean, to this day, you know, Serpentine Shell, Serpentine. Funny, funny movie.
Yeah. One of my favorite interviews ever was interviewing him and Bill Paxton together for Million Dollar Arm, that Disney movie from a few years ago.
No.
It was really, really funny. And the best part was when Bill Paxton was trying to explain to Alan Arkin what the plot of Edge of Tomorrow was. Because it was coming out, I think, that same summer.
Oh, no.
And it was absolutely hilarious. And now we've lost them both, so I really treasure that interview even more. Yeah.
So, well, all right. Well, anyway, folks, I promise we are now going to actually get to the entertainment news for this week. In fact, still no official numbers, Drew, but do you want to talk about what the projections were for Ruby Gilman?
Yeah, I mean, what everything that I've heard is that it's, you know, kind of in the high single digits. Mm-hmm. So like eight or 9 million probably for the weekend, which is not great. And it is another ding against original animated movies in the cinema, because obviously Elemental underperformed, but things like Super Mario Brothers overperformed. But yeah, and I just want to advocate for this movie because it's very sweet and very charming, and we love Kirk, who directed it. But yeah, it's a shame.
No, it is. It is. And I'm trying not to read too much in here. But for example, 2 days ago, the movie had been out a minute when they announced its release on digital July 18th of this month. And by the way, as soon as Drew and I finish recording here today, I'm going to do what I promised on last week's show. I'm going to go out in the rain and watch a whole bunch of movies back to back. And Ruby Gilman is one of the ones on my list, because I think it looks charming as hell. And this is one of these things where, as Drew just said, an original animated film that we should celebrate and support. And that just doesn't seem to be happening this year.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder how nervous Universal is about migration coming at the end of the year.
Yeah, I know, but you were saying great things about what you used.
I think it looks great. Mm-hmm. I mean, that and Wish are both, you know, original animated features still to come this year. And we still also have a Miyazaki movie opening at some point.
It is so interesting you say that, because just before we got started here today, I was sort of drilling down into that. The title's How Can You Live, or How Do You Live?
Yes, How Can I Live, okay. Something like that, yeah.
But the interesting thing is Miyazaki himself was concerned, because I guess it's opening in the next 4 weeks, and he's like, where's the promotional campaign? And this is supposedly the final Miyazaki.
Well, I had heard that they had said that they weren't doing a promotional campaign, that it is just going to open up and people are just going to go and see it. And what's interesting is it's based on a classic Japanese novel, but apparently all they did was take the title.
Wow.
So you can't even decipher what the plot will be based on the source material.
Okay.
And I've actually reached out to G Kids, and they won't tell me anything about a domestic release at all, which is weird, because you would think they would want it in the awards conversation.
Oh, no, definitely.
So it's a big mystery. I guess we'll know when it opens in Japan and people start talking about it online, but yeah.
All right. And speaking of people talking about it online, I was looking around, you know, that Nimona debuted on Netflix just this past Friday night, June 30th. And obviously, Drew and I have been talking about this movie for quite a while, so it was great to finally get to see it. And I would put Nimona up there with Klaus and the Sea Beast. I think, you know, this is some of the best animation that, you know, or I would put it side by side with some of the best animation up on Netflix.
Yeah, absolutely. What about Pinocchio, Jim? Good God.
Well, Pinocchio, I mean, it is an entirely different animal. I hate to say it, I still do that. It's like, well, no, that's hand-drawn, and that's CG, and that's stop-motion. And if anything, you know, when you look at something like Pinocchio and how crazy ambitious it was and what it did with stop-motion, I mean, it's just sort of like, there's Cloud 9, and then, you know, you have to look at Cloud 11. That's where I put it. I think he did such an amazing job with that. But
yeah,
what I liked about Nimona, they kept the broad strokes of N.D. Stevenson's graphic novel in place. Lots of big action set pieces, sprinkled with a little character-driven comedy. But anyway, we were talking a moment ago about what's going on with original animation. And I was making a comparison, because again, it's bothering me what's going on with Elemental. And so we are 15 days into its theatrical release, or at least that's the data that was available at Box Office Mojo. Stateside, it's made $80.8 million in ticket sales. If we compare that to Buzz Lightyear last year at this exact same time. So 15 days into its domestic release, it had already made $100.8 million. So it's on a 20% less pace. But at the same time, I had friends from Pixar reaching out, pointing out how well, for example, Elemental had done just this past Tuesday. And it's like, look, it's a Tuesday. We made $4 million. People are clearly talking about this movie and they're bringing their friends and family to see it. So it's like, they'd like us to talk about it at the end of the summer. And I can get behind that idea because I like Peter and I want this to succeed. But yeah, it is just so strange that it is doing the business that it is doing.
Word of mouth, Jim. Eh, word of mouth.
Well, okay. I'll try to talk to other people when I'm at the cinema today. Okay, some Warner Brothers related news now, folks. Want to remind you that this Thursday night, July 6th, at midnight, we get the first two episodes of My Adventures with Superman. It debuts on Adult Swim and shows up the very next day on Max. And have you seen this yet? Have you seen...
I haven't seen it. I actually don't know if I have screeners. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of an anime influence.
It is.
Superman. It looks really charming and fun.
Yeah, I'm thinking the same thing myself. So two episodes back to back till share a title. They're called The Adventures of a Normal Man.
Did you finish Unicorn Warriors Eternal?
I have not.
Have you started it?
Whoa, look at the time, Drew.
I know.
You have been saying such wonderful things about it, and it's just sort of like, tomorrow is my, in the morning while Nancy's teaching, I go out and do shopping, and literally on my list is to get myself a whiteboard that I can keep in within eyesight so I can do things like Nimona is available today. Go watch that. You know, Unicorn, yes. The thing you said you'd be watching for weeks. Go watch that. So I'm literally doing that. But also on that whiteboard would be The Venture Brothers, Radiant is the Blood of the Baboon Heart, which comes out July 21st from Warner Brothers Discovery Home Entertainment. And you've seen the trailer, you've seen the clips that are out there. What do we think?
Yeah. I mean, I'm very excited. I'm excited to see them wrap it up. I'm excited for a big R-rated, you know, Venture Brothers adventure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's on digital the 21st, and then it's on physical the 25th. So, Jim, if you want to find it on one of your Target runs, then okay. You can wait a few extra days. But
I will give that a shot. I have to say, I'm a little concerned about the Marnox marriage.
I mean, haven't you always been?
I have, but the stakes seem a little higher this time around. Oh, and speaking of cool stuff from Warner Brothers Discovery Home Entertainment, did you get to see the trailer for Babylon 5, The Road Home?
No, but I'm very intrigued by this, mm-hmm. particularly because you and I know that J. Michael Straczynski started out as an animation writer things like The Real Ghostbusters
he did.
Like that.
The original Babylon 5, which ran its syndication from February of 93 through November of 98, for the longest time, I would consider the gold standard for science fiction. It was a novel for television. And if you hung in there and watched all five seasons, they'd set up something in season two that wouldn't pay off till the tail end of hell. Season four, in the middle of season five. And it would just be one of the things you'd watch something and it's like, there was a wonderful scene with Stephen First's character, Veer, who talked about, you know, I'm looking forward to the day when your head will be on a pike, and, you know, and I can come up and wave at it. And it was something he said casually to a character again in season two. And then the fact that J. Michael Straczynski had mapped this all out, and in the middle of five, you actually got to see that. And it was only if you'd been paying attention for the whole show, was like, holy shit, that was great. And what's especially interesting is if you look at the vocal cast, they brought back so many of the people from the actual show. I mean, Bruce Boxleitner, Bill Momi, Claudia Christensen are coming back to voice the characters from the show. Even the gentleman who, Peter, what's his name, who did Londo. Really, really looking forward to this.
And I think this is supposed to be the first of several animated things,
right? I'm hoping.
Okay.
But did you see when J. Michael Straczynski talked about this in April. It was to the effect of, hey, we've got this thing coming for Warner Brothers Home Entertainment. And it's like, and look, I'm not announcing it. It's already done. You know, it'll be out in like weeks. And it was just one of these things like, what? So that's what you're hearing? There's a couple more behind this, or?
Yeah, that's what I've heard, that this is supposed to be the beginning of a new kind of series of these.
That would be so cool.
So buy it when it comes out.
All right.
On digital and
I will, Blu-ray. I will. Oh, speaking of Warner Brothers again, were you, from where you live in Toluca Lake, able to see the smoke from the fire on the Warner Brothers?
I didn't look for it. Yep. I think I was working. Okay. I was also suffering from a horrible medical issue this week, and I was probably in pain, curled up in a ball somewhere. Oh. But my favorite tweet was when someone had a picture of the smoke, and they said, "The Animaniacs have crowned a new pope."
No, I saw the same thing. It was a picture of the water tower with the black smoke behind it, and somebody to the effect of, "Oh, geez, I hope Yakko, Wakko, and Dot are okay." Or, you know, and there was another one to the effect of, "Well, this is what happens when Hulu, you know, opted not to renew the Animaniacs reboot beyond the third season." So, speaking of the Animaniacs reboot, okay, so remember, that got just two seasons. And when they announced that it was going to Hulu, it was two seasons of 13 episodes. That debuted November of 2020, did well enough that by February the following year, they announced a limited extension. I mean, they only went 10 episodes for a third season. But even then, they announced in December of 2002 that the third extension, which debuted in February of this year, that's it. There would be no more episodes of that. So
it's almost like that third season of only 10 episodes was produced during the main body of production and only released later as a quote-unquote third season. Listen, Jim, I'm no conspiracy theorist, but looking at the way that these companies treat animators and the staff, that seems like what it was. But, you know, I'm hoping that the success of these animated movies and TV shows this year give them a little bit more leverage in terms of getting the deals that they deserve, because you and I know that they work just as hard as the live action folk and sometimes harder.
Yeah,
so
yeah, those stories that were coming out about across the Spider-Verse, the year long, you know, 7 days a week, 11 hours a day working on that. Yikes. Before we leave Hulu here, I want to remind everybody that later this month, July 24th, we're finally going to get season 11 of Futurama, which again, as Drew will point out, yes, 10 episodes, but since they announced they were making 20, we know 12 is coming, and that's it. Also, and this is just for my own selfish pleasure here, but August 8th, season 3 of Only Murders in the Building will debut, so also on Hulu, so that will be my whiteboard, Drew.
I want less a whiteboard and more of a corkboard with string attached to it. Sort of like, I want this to look as much like it would be in the Riddler's hideout as possible.
Well, okay.
We can just make that happen, Jim. I don't know.
Trust me, this is not a body you want to see in a leotard, but I will work on that. Okay. And speaking of working, folks, when we get back from this break, after we chat about what's going on in the Disney live action feature side of the street, Drew's going to tell a story about what's been going on with Light the Fuse.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Okay, Drew, you wanted to talk about the Kazazi Moto trailer?
Yeah, I mean, this was something that debuted at Annecy that I didn't get to see, but is a collection of short. It's sort of like Star Wars Visions, but for African animation studios, and it looks really cool. It's executive produced by Peter Ramsey, who we love.
Of course,
From Guardians. What was the Guardians? What was that thing called?
Called Rise of the Guardians.
Rise of the Guardians.
He also is one of the three directors on the original animated Spider-Man, Into the Spider-Verse.
Yes, and he's directed episodes of The Mandalorian and
that's right.
Ahsoka
that's right.
this year.
That's
so.
Right. You know, yeah. So good stuff.
So it looks very cool, and I love that Disney is partnering with African studios. Mm-hmm. It looks really, really fun. Did you watch the trailer, Jim?
I did. And I like the look of it, like the color palette. I mean, it's just like, okay, this will be cool. On the other hand, the whole taking classic Disney shorts and remastering them for Disney Plus, I mean, I get that it's cool that these will now be accessible to folks who signed up for the subscription streaming service. In fact, that's been a constant drumbeat to the effect of, you know, where's the back library? Where's this film? Where's that film? So what are your thoughts on this project?
No, I agree. I mean, I think it is cool that they remastered them. Mm-hmm. I think that they need to put stuff on. I mean, the fact that the 100th anniversary is this year,
yeah.
And every month I look to see if there's any new catalog stuff on the platform, and there's just nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that Disney has kind of started to turn away from Disney Plus, I fear that those things will never get properly remastered and cleared. I know that the clearance issues are something that has held up a lot of the archival television programs or theme park stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But it just seems weird. Like, why couldn't they put the, you know, Indiana Jones and the Temple of the Forbidden Eye primetime special on for Indy? Or I don't know. It's a constant source of frustration, I feel like, especially when we had things like Walt Disney, which you and I would stay up until the wee hours of the morning watching and taping and, you know.
It was this wonderful time capsule. You could only see terrible, you know, specials from the 1970s. But at the same time, they were amazing snapshots of what was going on in the company at that time.
And they look good. They look good. I cannot tell you the amount of times I've watched that incredibly cringeworthy opening of Disney MGM Studios special. That's like 2 hours long. Give it to me in HD, Jim. I want to see
okay.
I want to see Michael Eisner mugging in 4K. By the way, did you watch that Mighty Ducks special on ESPN Plus?
No.
It's called Once Upon a Time in Anaheim. It's only an hour.
Okay.
Which is not great because they kind of try to fit everything into an hour.
Mm-hmm.
But they got Eisner to talk about the Mighty Ducks, which is really interesting. And the stadium and everything and how that all came to be.
Cow. I love that moment in Disney history where Eisner, you know, really got into sports. I mean, the company bought that chunk of the Los Angeles Angels. And I mean, I remember I was just talking with Jim Shull about how Kathy Magnum was in charge of redoing the stadium there. And they created, you know, this amazing piece of rock work that whenever they had a home run at an Angels game, this would be where the fireworks would erupt from. And,
yep.
And it just sort of, you know, but again, it's classic Eisner. You know, he's enthusiastic until he's not. And then the steel door descends and, you know, we're no longer in the sports business. And it's like, really? Really?
Yeah, they flirted with buying the Lakers at one point. So, I mean, that's how serious they.
God,
yeah.
That's
great. My favorite thing about the Mighty Ducks, Jim, mm-hmm. and you'll appreciate this, is, you know, since the stadium was already created, mm-hmm. Eisner couldn't have a hand in the architecture of it. So what did he do? He hired Frank Gehry to design the practice center for the Ducks.
Of course.
Of course, yes.
Of course. So, yeah. So you had a building that looked like it was going a million miles an hour.
That's right.
Okay.
The postmodern masterpiece that is now home to, like, you know, little kids' birthday parties or whatever.
Oh,
yeah.
That's so funny. We were just talking about Disney's 100th anniversary. And another component of that, did you see where later this summer the slew of Disney and Pixar movies will be showing up, you know, returning to theaters for brief runs and that sort of thing?
I saw that, yeah.
And I don't want to be negative here, but if I were picking things to put back into theaters, I mean, I get it. It's the 100th anniversary, and, you know, let's do some films from the 70s, let's do some films from the 80s, let's do some things from the 90s. But it's like, there were those of us who really wanted to see Soul on the big screen.
I agree completely. Yeah. I agree completely.
Or for that matter, Turning Red or Luca. The notion of getting to see those three up on the big screen, I mean, so, you know, let's go back to the movie theater and see The Lion King again.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Yeah.
I don't know why they didn't do that.
Yeah.
But
I mean, it just seems like a missed opportunity. And I think at a time when maybe the folks up in Emeryville are feeling a little dinged through kind of the 1-2 punch of what happened last year with Lightyear and now what's going on with Elemental, and the chance to get to see some of the films that they labored on finally up on a big screen. I just wish somebody had thought to do that. In addition to, I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm going to go out and see The Rescuers again on the big screen. It'll be fun. But we've been talking about films that have come out not quite done the business that they expected to. And, of course, The Little Mermaid, the Rob Marshall remake of the Disney hand-drawn classic from 1989, came out in May of this year. And right now, it literally is the fifth highest grossing film to date of all of 2023. It's done $277 million stateside, a $209 million overseas. So it's over the $500 million threshold worldwide. But Drew, you and I were pre-gaming and you were talking about how this is not what the company expected from this movie, right?
No, absolutely. And they were hoping for something closer to Beauty and the Beast, or even Aladdin, which crept over the $1 billion mark, basically because Korea loved it so much, and people were going time and time again.
Really?
Yeah.
Korea is what pushed
it. Yeah, it was like a Korean phenomenon. Yeah,
wow,
yeah.
That...
It's really interesting. But yeah, this is going to make about half of what they predicted, and honestly, it probably won't make that any money. I mean, I'm sure merchandising will, but you know, they say that you have to make three times your production budget to break even. And as you know, Jim, this thing was beset by problems COVID shutdowns and the amount of post-production tinkering that went on with it, the amount of CGI. I mean, this must be one of the most expensive movies Disney has ever produced. Yeah. And you need more than $500 million. I know $500 million sounds great, but for something like this.
No. You need a number that's far north of this point to finally come out of the red. And you did a sit down with Sean Bailey, the gentleman in charge of Walt Disney Studios. And you guys got to talk the length and breadth of the live action Disney business. I mean, which, remember, started back in March of 2015 with Kenneth Branagh's, you know, Cinderella making.
Yeah, I would argue my conversation with Sean is much better than what was in the New York Times a couple weeks ago.
I would agree.
Yeah, it seemed like a weird kind of political maneuver to get Sean out in the press. But yeah, I mean, what's remarkable is how little things have changed since I talked to him in 2017.
Didn't Sean, when you talked with him, talk about there was literally sort of a break point as the effect of these are the films we'll do live action of, but not these? You know, wasn't there kind of a line they weren't going to cross?
Yeah, I mean, he said like late 90s, early 2000s, which Moana is literally filming in August. I just ran into Jared Bush actually at the Hollywood Bowl.
Oh.
And he said it was weird kind of, you know, rewriting his own screenplay because he wrote the new version as well.
Oh, how weird.
Yeah.
Wow.
But yeah, so I mean, 2016 to 2023 is not exactly a large gulf of time.
No.
And I think that was maybe they're readjusting because of things like Little Mermaid not performing like they thought they would. I mean, I don't really understand why they've kind of dropped off. Maybe there's just so many, but yeah, the one interesting thing from the New York Times article was that he's thinking of The Lion King, and you and I are both fascinated by this, as a new universe like Star Wars or Marvel that will support different stories within that structure, which is frankly bizarre considering how static and emotionless that new version of the movie was. I mean, you and I saw the footage from Barry Jenkins' new movie. Which is... Yeah. Is considerably more interesting looking, I would say, but still, those animals have no expressions.
No,
so I don't know what.
No. When Top Gun Maverick came out last year, Drew was, you know, go see this on the biggest possible screen. And I wound up watching it at a plane on the, you know, 3-inch by 6-inch screen. And it was an amazing movie. It was a great time. I really enjoyed it. On the other hand, on a previous trip out to the West Coast, I was killing time. And I wound up watching the Lion King live-action remake again on that little screen on the back of a seat of a plane. And it was terrible. I mean, it was just the very thing you're talking about, where particularly with the CG animal versions of Pumbaa and Timon and the like, but now tiny faces and tiny expressions, and it just did not work for me. And it was just sort of like, this is kind of a slavish copy of what we did in, you know, this scene is a slavish copy of the hand-drawn animated version of Vanity Form, and this scene is a slavish copy, and it's like,
yeah,
what is
it's
the point?
It's a real lack of imagination, mm-hmm. and it's also very interesting that with all the technological prowess that we have now, mm-hmm. it's not as dazzling as what 50 overweight white guys could come up with in Burbank. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like, how is this possible? Yeah. Like, there is just no, that's why part of me really loved Peter Pan and Wendy, because mm-hmm. at least it went outside of the 53 original and mm-hmm. kind of incorporated new elements and wasn't so slavishly devoted. And mm-hmm. I worry that the closer the original movie is to the release of the new one, mm-hmm. the more indebted they feel to it.
The next thing we're going to see, March of 2024, is Snow White. And I was talking with somebody at the studio who basically said, well, we know that one will do better at the box office because we have two white leads. Everybody who dug in there.
No, we don't have two. Rachel Zegler is Latin.
Interesting, because that was not what I was told.
Colombian, Jim. She's Colombian.
Fascinating. Okay, but yes. You know, but they just figure, well, people aren't going to notice that, you know, because again, the name is Snow White, you know, and it's just sort of like,
right,
you know,
right.
As opposed to, you know, the having a lovely, talented African-American teen play Ariel in The Little Mermaid, and that somehow put the brakes on what it's going to make. But at the same time, Gal Gadot was out. She was talking with Vogue Hong Kong about working on this project last week or thereabouts. And she was saying, I think it was so much fun to play the Evil Queen. There's something delicious about the part because it's a fairy tale and she's the first Disney villain. And I wanted to make sure that we kept the queen delightful and delicious, and wanted to make sure we knew how she ticked, that her evilness was interesting and not just flat. And so evidently the script for this thing, this Mark Webb movie, they've introduced an element of complexity to the relationship between Snow White and the Evil Queen. There's a kind of a mother-daughter thing going on here, but...
Oh, boy. Here we go.
Well, but at the same time, it's just what's interesting for the motivation of Gadot's queen characters. So, like, what happens to a woman when she feels she's not relevant anymore? What can come out of that? And... beyond that, she talked about the challenges of production, that the costume for the Evil Queen was heavy as hell, and because it's a musical, and evidently the Queen has two numbers, so she could stretch her performance and make it that much more animated, and she hasn't seen it yet, you know, so it's like, it was super fun to make, and I can't wait to see how it turns out.
That's the other thing that I think is wrong with these movies, mm-hmm. is that they sit in the oven mm-hmm. for so long that they come out and they have no flavor. They are burnt to a crisp, mm-hmm. Jim. And there is just nothing left. Everything's been pre-vizzed and post-vizzed mm-hmm. and noted to death. And there is just nothing there that's I mean, think about how cool an Aladdin made by Guy Ritchie sounds on paper mm-hmm. and then what it ended up being. You know, it's like there's just no personality to these things. And it's just... They shot this movie years ago. We saw footage of it at D23 last year.
At the same time, we just saw in the trades this past week about Sarah Polley, who won the Academy Award this past year for Best Adapted Screenplay for Women Talking. She's been signed to direct a Bambi redo that Disney first talked about when? Early 2020. And... are you lying awake at night? You know, there's so many unanswered questions, you know, about the original Bambi.
I mean, Sarah Polley doing it is very interesting.
I get that. I get that. But on the other hand, I thought the exact same thing when they said that Robert Zemeckis and Tom Hanks were going to get together and make Pinocchio. And dear God, I keep meaning to circle back on that movie to the effect of it can't be as bad as I remember. But it was just so bad.
It's bad. Mm-hmm. I don't know why it was so bad, but I was kind of holding out hope, but yeah. I mean, Sarah Polley, I think it will not, you know, allow for something
okay.
on the Pinocchio level.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, comparing women talking to whatever, to the witches, mm-hmm. you know, it's like, those are two very different films. But I think that you could do something really interesting with Bambi mm-hmm. by making it kind of an animal rights type movie, but I don't know if that's going to be something that Disney wants to do.
That's interesting.
They sound good on paper, Jim. They sound wonderful on paper, and then you watch them and you are just bored to tears.
You and I have talked about how much, you know, how big a fan we are of Chris Anders and Dean DuBois. And seeing the original How to Train Your Dragon in theaters was honestly one of my favorite times at the movies. So less of a fan of the two sequels. I don't think, you know, it was kind of the Xerox of a Xerox thing. So the notion that here's Universal borrowing a page from Disney's playbook and getting its own live action, you know, How to Train Your Dragon in production, that's a little concerning too. It's like, oh no, other people doing this.
You want to see a live action Despicable Me with Steve Carell. Don't lie.
Okay. Maybe that one. Maybe that one. All right. Well, before we close out here, we have been teasing this news forever, which was why it was so delightful this past week to finally sort of have it out there in the world that Drew and Charles Hood's wonderful Light Diffuse podcast got a kind of an extended name.
Yes, yes, it did, Jim. We are now Light Diffuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. Can you believe it?
Yes, I can. You and Charles worked so hard for so long, interviewing so many people and getting so many great stories out there about the Mission Impossible films. It's easy to see how you guys would have come on Paramount's radar, and it's like, we should bring that in-house. But can you talk a little bit about how that happened when they reached out?
Well, yeah, I mean, I literally pitched them, I think, 2 years ago mm-hmm. on the idea of bringing us in. Mm-hmm. And it was just one of those processes. Mm-hmm. Jim, you know how the studio system works.
Well, we were just talking about the Disney live action animated thing staying in the oven for 2-3 years at a time. So, you know.
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, it was just like, you know, slowly we kept on them, and I think our status grew, mm-hmm. and obviously there are two new movies coming out, including Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1, yep. opening on July 12th. Mm-hmm. Get your tickets now. But a lot of it was Tom. Honestly, a lot of it was him just fighting for us and making sure that we got what we deserved, and we owe a lot to him and Christopher McQuarrie and Eddie Hamilton and the whole gang making the movies, because they were always really passionate about what we were doing and very helpful. Mm. And yeah, I mean, this is a new era. We've got such great guests coming up and multiple episodes every week. So if you're a fan of Light the Fuse, get ready. But if you're not, I'm sorry, I guess, because there will be many, many more.
But weren't you mentioning that you also have, like, as part of this new, under the Paramount umbrella, there's an animated film coming up?
Yes, okay. We are doing a little something for Ninja Turtles. We're calling it Light the Ooze, Jim. yeah, that'll be, we don't know when those are going to come out, but we've talked to Jeff Rowe already. Mm. I've seen the movie again, Jim, mm. and this is not me being a corporate mm-hmm. chill, but I really, it might be my favorite movie of the year, honestly.
Wow.
I love it so much.
Well, think about how we talked about Mitchells versus Machines back in the day. And so this is his next time up at bat.
Yeah. Jackie Chan fans in particular will love what he does with Splinter. It is just excellent. I loved the movie so, so much. But anyway, both of these movies are great. Mm-hmm. They're both coming out this summer from Paramount, mm-hmm. and we will be talking about both of them a lot on Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast.
And again, you know, I have no right to be this proud and happy for you, you know, but I am. I'm just by extension.
But you've been along for the, you know, yeah. I would check in with you periodically and say, oh my God, it's not looking good, Jim. It's not looking good. And
but
now
no,
here we
just,
are.
It's just so thrilling that it actually happened, that what you and Charles managed to do when you were on the outside, you know, the interviews you got, the people you talked with, and just the notion that Paramount is now holding open the door. It's like, oh, cannot wait to listen to the shows that are yet to come. So again, just want to remind you folks that's Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast.
Yes, we will be premiering on July 11th, mm-hmm. which is right in the window of Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1 opening.
That is.
So you can listen to us, go see the movie, listen to us, whatever you want to do. But there'll be tons of content coming out for Dead Reckoning Part 1. We have amazing guests. We have really amazing guests, so get ready.
That is so cool. And by the way, we have a couple of cool podcasts here, too. We have Disney Dish that I do with Len Testa. Likewise, we have Marvelous Disney, which I do with Aaron Adams. By the way, he has a podcast of his own, 32nd Street. And we also have Looking at Lucasfilm. And when Brian and I sit down next, we will talk about Dial of Destiny, which I'm waiting to hear the noise that Drew makes at this point, because... You know, that you weren't happy with that movie, right?
No.
There we go. Okay.
Have you watched it yet?
No. Again, this is my big movie day. I go out and watch, okay. You know, everything back to back to back to back. And
just text me when you get out. That's all.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, I tell you what, folks, if you could do Drew and I a favor, if you could head over to Apple Podcasts and rate and review, well, not just the show you're listening to right now, Fine Tuning, but also... the soon to have expanded name, you know, Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast. Given what just happened with Twitter this past weekend, is this kind of the final straw for you, Drew? Or
it's pretty bad, Jim. It's like if someone can get me a Blue Sky invite, apparently they were just deluged yesterday with people joining. So. Maybe we'll head over to Blue. You'll have to come with me, Jim, to Blue Sky.
I'm definitely thinking about it because it was weird yesterday.
Yeah. But yeah, Drew Taylor, like a Taylor cheered on Instagram and Twitter for now.
Mm-hmm. Likewise here, Twitter and Instagram is Jim Hill Media, over at Facebook as Jim Hill Media News. Let's see, beyond that, if you nice folks like what you heard here today and want to head over to Bandcamp and subscribe, that would be cool. But I think that'll... do it. On behalf of Mr. Taylor, thank you for listening. And again, just want to remind you, again, it's July 11th, you know, the official debut of...
July 11th, Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast will be in your ears. Get ready, Jim. It's a fun one.
Cannot wait. But we, too, will be back with a new episode sometime next week. But till then, thanks for listening, folks.